What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar.
And I'm Deputy Editor of News Nathan Ingram.
Hey, Nate. This week, we'll be talking about a bunch of different cool AI things. AI put me in a South Park episode. We'll be talking about all of that. And also, one of our writers has been writing about digital immortality, which is basically powered by AI, too. So stay tuned for all that, folks. And also stay tuned to the end of the episode. We'll have a chat with the director of They Clone Tyrone, a new sci-fi movie hitting Netflix that stars John Boyega and Jamie Foxx. And it is a lot of fun. So stay tuned for all of that. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review in iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And again, our live streams, which typically occur Thursday mornings, are on hiatus for now for the summer, but we're hoping to bring them back. Let us know if you really like them. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Now on to our first big AI story. This week, folks, I visited the town of South Park, Colorado. Not really. It was AI. AI put me in South Park and created a whole version of an episode with me, a digitized version of my voice. It built a story around a prompt that I provided, and it's all pretty wild. That came from The Simulation. They're developing a technology called Showrunner AI that is going to allow creators to do things like this, to create TV shows or build virtual worlds that they can build stories from. Joining us to talk about this is Edward Saatchi, the CEO of The Simulation. Hey, Edward, how's this going?
Great. Yeah, very lovely to be with you.
Good to chat. And first off, I want to say, can you tell us, you have been working on the idea of AI storytelling for a while. We talked when you were running Fable Studios, and you guys had a great VR project. You did a VR version of Neil Gaiman's The Wolves in the Wall?
Wolves in the Walls, yeah.
That was a really cool thing, and you built an interactive character around that. Can we just backtrack a bit? So you were really into VR. You were also heading up Oculus Story Studio for a while, too. Can you talk us about the path that led you to, you know, doing a project like this, like doing AI storytelling?
Totally. Yeah, so, I co-founded Oculus Story Studio, and we were focused on creating virtual reality tools and entertainment, and won two Primetime Emmys for our work, created Quill, the painting application, so that people could tell stories and bring them to life. And our last virtual reality experience, Wolves in the Walls, had a character called Lucy, who would talk to you and interact with you, and you could go on adventures together. And this had no AI. This was 2017. So this character would talk to you, look at you, kind of follow you, but they wouldn't really have a conversation with you. But people really wanted to talk to this character. We could see, you know, we'd be looking at them in the experience. And that made me think, you know, wouldn't it be amazing to really take what we've done bringing characters to life, and with AI, you know, take that to the level all the way to AGI, where you're actually bringing a character to life. And so I spun
out. Can we explain the concept of AGI real quick for listeners?
It stands for Artificial General Intelligence, and it means an AI that is as smart as us. And that's a line that's always moving. Once AI does something, we say that's not really intelligence. So it's not a measurable thing, but we all assume that we'll know it when we see it, or when it attacks us, or the rest. So I spun out of Oculus to create Fable, and Fable is the company behind The Simulation. So The Simulation is our theory of how to build AIs. But at first, we were building an AI chatbot of this character in 2017, 2018. And it wasn't just text, it was also video. You could video chat. But we just thought it was all very boring. And we still think that single-agent chatbots are the wrong path, where you're just talking one-on-one to this AI. We think that it shouldn't be like the movie Her. It should be like Westworld, Free Guy, Truman Show, where it's a society of these characters and AIs that are all prompting each other, training each other. You can train the society, but an AI shouldn't exist outside of context, and it shouldn't exist to talk to you and you know, interact with you. It should have its own life, be busy, and, you know, potentially have jobs and do things in the simulation and beyond. You know, be a remote worker who gets up at 7 a.m. in the simulation, goes to their office and logs on to Slack and is your coworker at your company.
Yeah, capitalism survives even in the simulated AI world.
That was a really interesting thing is that because we were trying to design the economics for a modern city, and it's really horrifying two things. One is like everything just ends up in monopoly, right? Yeah. Not meaning monopoly the game, but like meaning one person just trying to crush everyone else and take all the money, and everything just funnels up to them whilst they do nothing. And then the other is that nothing makes sense without a kind of ennui, so a kind of just an endless need for more consumer goods that has no relation to your needs or really anything rational. You just need the next thing. So we had to program that into them.
I remember the first or second Matrix where they talk about, we've made other matrices, and one was total perfection and peace, and people just went insane because they didn't know what to do with peace.
With all of your energy. So they didn't believe it.
It's not possible.
So, Nate, this is probably the first time you're hearing a lot of these ideas around this. You saw the South Park episode. Do you have any thoughts at this point?
I do. And I was at first startled at how much like you it sounded. The avatar also looks much like you, and I think South Park seems like the ideal place to start with this, right? Because the characters are so simplistic, it's easy to like make an avatar out of probably minimal input, right? Mm-hmm. And then
you finish, and then I just want to cue a point where Ben can put in a clip of the episode too, but you go ahead.
Yeah. You know, the first thing, after noticing how much sounded like you, I started to pick up on, you know, a bit of roboticness in the voices of all the characters, particularly yours. But tell me, how much audio was this working with to create this model?
Not much. I mean, minutes. Right. It doesn't need much anymore.
Yeah, we had like a 15-20 minute chat, Edward, and you said you were using that audio to make the simulated voice.
Yeah, but in general, it doesn't need very much.
The conversation you guys had wasn't like directed in any certain way, or
it's more about like the cleanness. It's kind of like podcasting. It's more about the cleanness than it is anything else. But that's where we got to was probably state of the art, so it's not perfect. It's maybe 90% of the way, though.
Gotcha. Let's take a step back here. Let's play a clip from this simulated South Park episode featuring my voice and simulated versions of the South Park cast as well. And then we'll be right back to this. Hello, anyone home? I've got some urgent news.
It's 7 in the morning. This better be good.
It's not just good, it's crucial. Did you know that artificial intelligence is taking over the world?
AI, huh? Like in those sci-fi movies?
Exactly, Mr. Marsh. And if we don't act now, they'll control everything.
Here we go again with another end-of-the-world spiel.
So, Devendra, how exactly do these robots plan to enslave us?
Well, they're infiltrating every aspect of our lives. They're in our phones, our cars, even our toasters.
Our toasters, really? I always knew that little bastard was up to something.
Randy, don't encourage him.
So what should we do then? Smash all of our electronics and live in caves?
That would be a start. Okay, so we're onto some big topics already. We're talking about AGI. We're kind of talking about complete virtual societies. But, you know, as it is right now, Edward, you have a product that seems like can just create TV episodes or create content out of some of these simulated worlds. Can you talk about like why you started with South Park to do this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Nathan was saying the most obvious thing, which is it's simple visual style means that it's actually achievable today by artificial intelligence to do, because it's not just the showrunner and show one model that we created isn't about the script only. It's got to edit, do music, understand scene structure, do, you know, all of that kind of animate. And the fact that it's so simple is really helpful. I think there's a couple of other things. One is just that we admire and love South Park. It's kept its quality up for years. And also that Matt and Trey created maybe the best deep fake work of art, Sassy Justice, which was the sort of Trump deep fake, if nobody saw it in, I think, 2019. And they created a company, Deep Voodoo, focused on deep fake. So, you know, to an extent, we thought, well, we're all there in the same boat. So, you know, hopefully they won't look too unkindly on research around their brilliant work.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from them yet, Edward? Because no. The stuff has been out there, right?
No, and we're terrified to hear from them. But we don't. Okay. I mean, if somebody says, oh, you know, do a take it down, we're totally fine to take it down. This is for research, and we're not releasing the ability to make new South Park episodes. We want to be safe about this, but we did want to explain, you know, during the strikes that this this is possible, and, you know, this is the moment of highest possible leverage in the last 60 years to have both the actors and writers striking. And so it's probably the correct moment to be as aggressive as possible to say producers should not be allowed to use AI without the permission of artists. And that seemed to be one of the areas where it broke down, that the producers wanted to be able to use it and inform artists. And instead it should be, you know, artists are driving it. And if a producer wants to do anything, they need the permission of the artist. You know, that was one of the areas where it seemed like things broke down. And we would totally side with the actors and writers, because it is, there are producers who will look at this and say, great, you know, this is fantastic for these artists. They're so difficult. Let's just do this all ourselves, the business people.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there's any concern that releasing this now during the strike kind of gives the leverage the opposite way. Like you're sort of, it's like a test case where you're showing, hey, look what we can do. And this is a fairly, you know, recent or new piece of technology. Like if it's this in its infancy, what can you imagine we'll do in a few years, right?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Someone could go into a negotiation and say, well, you know, we've got our best alternative to a negotiated agreement. We're just going to do that. Luckily, it's not good enough for that argument to hold. But, you know, if that community is going to set the rules of the road for the next decade or two decades until there's another strike of the same level of power, everyone should be as informed as possible about what AI could be doing, and then negotiate a deal with the best information.
I'm wondering, this week is also seeing the premiere of Oppenheimer. You know, I'm going to make a bit of an analogy here. Like, I think, you know, Oppenheimer knew exactly what he was making, but not the full power, right, or the full impact of creating something like the atomic bomb. I think we are waiting for a major AI revolution, you know, something that could hit that level and also impact potentially the pop culture world in this way. Are you worried about like accelerating that at all? Because I think that's really what the artists and writers are worried about right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's I guess there's two sides to it. One is that I don't love the Oppenheimer LARPing that I see in a lot of the AI community. There was an interview with a lot of the folks from Anthropic, and the journalist was clearly slightly teasing, and that he was saying, you know, and then the engineer said, there's a 30% chance we'll all be killed in the next few years, and then took a bite from his cheese sandwich. And it was just like, come on, guys, we're not in a movie. So far, we've had a similar impact, perhaps, to Microsoft Excel. There's not a war for the freedom of, you know, everyone. And we have not created the atomic bomb. So Oppenheimer won the war, changed the world. We have not. But that aside, for Hollywood or for cinema, I'm very excited about movies that could be more like novels and paintings. Cinema has necessarily been a collaborative medium, but you know, I think that probably means that some people who could make amazing films and TV shows are not able to. Because they're just not willing to do the hustle necessary, or they're total misanthropes. And I'd like to see what those people, you know, create. Very strange people, probably, with very different ideas than just reboots and requels and sequels and all of that.
Gotcha. I mean, that's definitely the rosier scenario for those artists to get a chance to create
the rise
things.
Of the misanthropes.
Right. I mean, that's been a thing in media for a long time. Like, go back to, I mean, even before Catcher in the Rye or something, right? Like that a part of the genius of like the early Simpsons is one of those writers was one of those crazy folks who just like lived in the middle of nowhere and everybody thought he was
right.
Kind of
Does anyone really think J.D. Salinger would be comfortable like controlling a set and like fighting with the actors? But he's a great artist. You know, could artists like that, great novelists, great painters, who are very solitary, could they contribute to this medium where we go in and we look up on the screen? There's nothing. There's nothing to say that isn't possible.
For sure. I would just say, like, looking at the state of Hollywood right now, though, and looking at, like, what, how the producers are responding to the strikes and how the studios are responding, like, not right now, people, the writers are striking over residuals for streaming services and also for the use of AI for their work. And same thing for the actors, too. And it just seems like the other side, the studios, don't even want to negotiate these terms, because what we were hearing is that basically the studios wanted to capture artists and use their digital likenesses with no pay. Like, just capture them, use them with no pay moving forward, and they think that's just fine. The fact that they're not even negotiating right now, none of the big studios or even the streaming services like Netflix are negotiating with creators, does not make me, like, that makes me think if we put a tool like this out there, they're going to just go for the lowest common denominator thing. Like, they're just going to, okay, we need to make more content now because we don't have our creators anymore, right?
Well, I think the more frightened or the more informed, maybe they go together, about AI we are, the less the studios can put in an insane clause like that, because everybody's on the lookout, right? I mean, that was horrifying. I think, you know, it's easier to negotiate when you have full information. And so I think that the guilds should be as aggressive as possible, and that they have maximum leverage right now. But you're right, the studios aren't budging. I think probably if I was to look at the most positive case on their side, it would probably be that this whole AI thing is only like 2 months old. So, you know, do we want to lock in for 20 years that we can't use this? You know, that doesn't sound good, because we have no idea where it's going. So it's a difficult time for people to make decisions, and so the more informed they are about what might be coming, maybe the less paranoid, you know, people will be, and more like, okay, well, this is roughly where the technology might go, so let's negotiate fair rules of the road for that, which in our mind would be, it has to be done with an artist's permission and should be being driven by the artists.
Gotcha. You also brought up the concept of AGI right at the beginning. You know, we haven't really talked about that much here. And I've talked to a lot of AI researchers who are like, that whole thing, that whole mission to create a complete virtual being, that sounds like Ray Kurzweil talking about the singularity, right? Like, it's almost like, you know, it's like Jesus's second coming or something. There's like a religious devotion to this idea that it could actually happen. I see you progressing towards it, or at least building towards that concept. First of all, do you think, like, is it ethical for us to even try to attempt to create a complete virtual being? Because in your setup, right, you're trying to just put them in another world, right, where they have to experience ennui. They have to experience, like, the horrors of living, you know, in the world, I guess, like, have a job and everything.
Yeah, I mean, they can live in many different worlds. You know, players and creators will build, you know, thousands of simulations, some like the modern world, some completely different, and also be able to see, you know, if we make this a more communist society, what does that do to the pleasure and happiness of these AIs and all of that? Or it's far future, there's no money. So you can set up any kind of simulation that you want. And, you know, I think our feeling is that most of the valley is focused on a very linear approach to AGI, which is more data and more GPUs. And we believe in emergence and crowdsourcing. And our hope is that, you know, from the simulation will emerge or will grow an intelligence in an unpredictable, wild way that, you know, you could only trace back after it's happened. And that seems like a much more logical way to create life than just spending money on GPUs and scraping data.
I mean, there's so much we don't know. We've talked about this on the show before, but just the notion of consciousness is something we don't even fully understand. So in humans, so it's just like we're just kind of throwing so many ideas at the wall to try to have it emerge digitally.
Well, Sam at OpenAI said a few months ago that he was disappointed to start to feel that intelligence was not unique to us, was not special, was something that you know, was mundane and everywhere and on a spectrum from plants to us and machines. And I don't know if I agree with that, but it would be a profound shift, probably as big as the Galileo, you know, we're not the center of the universe kind of thing. I just don't know what will happen.
There's a lot we don't know. There were stories recently about octopuses basically making cities under the sea, like making living structures and just environments for them to all live in together as a society. So I don't know. There's a lot we will be seeing. Well, you know what, Edward Saatchi, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this. We'll be keeping an eye on the simulation and everything. Where can we find you online these days?
Yeah, you can go to at Fable Simulation on Twitter or thesimulation.co and yeah, get involved.
Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you. Bye.
Let's move on to another story that is powered by AI and also pretty out of this world. Let's talk about digital immortality. Joining us to talk about that is James True from Spain. Hey, James.
How's it going, guys?
Going good. And you wrote this piece, Digital Immortality is Coming and We're Not Ready for It. Great headline and also great concept, too. So can you, like, broadly, what are you exploring in this piece?
Yeah, so this all started, I was just looking around, you know, some topics, and AI was blowing up earlier in the year. And I came across this company. They actually showed a product at CES, but we totally went under the radar. And it was, they're an established company. They're called Deep Brain AI. And they're sort of best known for those like AI-generated news avatars and sort of things like that, or maybe like those touchscreen video hotel receptionist things that you interact with or whatever. But they've done a product which is called Rememory. And basically you make an AI avatar of yourself, you record your voice, and you go to a studio and they video you and all the rest of it. And the idea is that you can create this avatar that your family can interact with after you pass, shall we say. And I saw it and I thought it was fascinating. So I started looking in, and there are a few other things in this category. It's actually got a name, which is Grief Tech. And just the whole thing was fascinating because I don't think, I mean, it sounds like the future. We've always wanted this idea we could upload our brain, right? And that's kind of a Hollywood staple. But when you think about what the reality of it and everything that's going wrong with AI at the moment, it feels like we're playing with fire a little bit. That was the impetus.
Yeah.
For the story.
It sounds like the setup for a Black Mirror episode, James. You what was the rom-com or something? It was a romantic film.
Truly Madly Deeply.
So you thought of Truly Madly Deeply. I thought of The Final Cut, which is this Robin Williams movie, which is sci-fi. Nobody quite realized it, but it's a world where all of your memories are recorded, and he is a cutter. He is somebody who edits your final memories, which gets played on your tombstone, I believe. So it's like, this is a concept that's been around for a while, I guess, right?
I preferred my reference because anything with Alan Rickman, basically.
I remember this Robin.
I mean, yes, you win. You win.
I was going to say, I remember this Robin Williams movie, though. I haven't seen it, but like it was that time from like 2002 to 2004 where he was doing like some really weird stuff that people didn't necessarily dig.
He did 1 Hour Photo, which was like a weird like horror serial killer. But anyway, that concept, Black Mirror has brought up this idea, you know, of different ways of interacting with, you know, our loved ones via AI. There's also the Amazon show Upload, which I'm thinking of, which is a whole nother thing. That is, your consciousness is magically ripped out of your skull and thrown into a virtual world. In exploring this, James, like, so you were intrigued by the idea. What did you learn about Deep Brain and what they're doing here?
Yeah, so it turns out they were kind of fun to speak with because they were, didn't really get why I was suspicious of this product.
What's the problem? Come on.
They're drinking their own Kool-Aid.
Yeah, but they were also quite direct as well. They were just like, oh, we developed chatbot technology, and then we also did generative videos. So we just thought, put them together and we can do this thing. But it intrigued me, their specific product, because it was so expensive, $10,000-ish to make your avatar. And then you have to pay to go and see it. Separately.
Oh,
because it's
man.
Offsite.
The admission fee is a real bummer.
Right, but
that's actually kind of genius, but okay.
Well, to be fair, it does tie in. They're a Korean company. It does tie into a Korean mourning tradition, which is on the I can't remember if it's the birthday or the death day. Someone please remind me. But typically family would go and spend time at a grave or something like that. So it's not just completely made up. And also it means that you're not, there's no servers involved necessarily. So your data is stored locally in that one place. But that was the whole thing that interested me, was you're entrusting a lot to the, these companies. And if you look at some of the comments on the piece, people make sort of interesting points as well, which is just sort of passing a burden onto either the company or your family, at which point you turn this off, or, you know, what happens to that digital legacy as well. There's just, it just throws up infinite little things that you think about. You're like, well, what are they doing with my data? What if there's a data breach? What if the place burns down? Have we lost grandma? You know, like...
Yeah, you're saying there's no servers, it's all locally stored. That is a bad thing, I would say. I think you'd want that stored so that there's a service that the entire family can log on to and say hi to grandma, you know, anywhere in the world.
Then that opens it up to, like, well, yeah, what if hackers steal grandma? And then this whole concept, we're laughing, but, like, digital, yeah, hostages? This could be, like, someone could be hostaging your grandma, right? And they say, well, I've got this avatar stored.
Yeah, we can make her say whatever, yeah.
Yep. And then that's
I was just going to say, the first thing I thought of is, like, when you think about, like, AI bots that get trained in weird ways and start, like, saying horrible things. I'm like, imagine grandma becoming an even bigger racist, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, or, you know.
Or just glitching out, right? That's sort of max headroom. Like, you're going to see grandma and she starts, like, sort of that digital sort of distortion.
Somebody reboot grandma, please. Like, going all max headroom on us. Like, oh, that would be kind of fun. Does this company have any thoughts about, I guess, how this affects our normal process of grieving, right? Like, it's a thing we all have to deal with. Like, when somebody passes, we kind of exist on the memories that they've left behind, and it gets kind of fuzzy. Those memories and reality gets kind of fuzzy. But this thing, I think, for if this takes off, like, this will be the memory eventually for a lot of people. Is that weird? Do they think about that?
Yeah, so unsurprisingly, I think it's, like, when you speak to any company, they'll be like, well, we see it as a benefit because it helps with grieving, you know, and sure, that sort of thing.
Delay the process, yeah.
Right, but yeah, that's a tomorrow problem. But but if you speak to most sort of members of the public, that's obviously the first thing they'll be like, isn't it a bad thing to sort of, like, perpetuate this longing and this mourning for a lost one and stuff like that. So I think it's hard, right? We've all probably lost someone, and occasionally, I mean, Google will burp up photos for hey, here's this memory from 6 years ago, and then there's, like, someone who's no longer with us, right? So we do have a form of that right now.
I think Facebook, that's where it pops up a lot for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just think it's a bit worse when it's sort of living, breathing, well, not living, but three-dimensional and interactive definitely adds another dimension to that.
Gotcha. You also covered another company that's doing something similar by creating entirely, was it virtual voices of your loved
ones? Yeah, so this one's more interesting, I think, in a way. It's not more so much more interesting, but it's a bit more practical. They're called Hereafter AI, and you as a willing participant fill out, there's a questionnaire, I think, and you speak your answers into it, and it does all the processing, and then someone else can speak with that virtual person. There's a good story. I forget the where you'll find it, but someone did it with their living grandparents. So and just as a little comparison, so that's a bit more interesting because I think it's a bit more benevolent, and the questions are not like, they're obviously going to be sort of fun and nice stuff and memories and stories and things like that. So it's you can conjure them up and hear a memory from them on demand rather than interact with a chatbot in disguise.
James, there's a movie called Marjorie Prime. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but Sherlyn and I have talked about this before. It's also one. It's about a service that provides holographic recreations of your deceased loved ones, and it allows a woman to come face-to-face with the younger version of her husband. That movie, it's a little indie movie, but has some great actors, including John Hamm, Gina Davis, Tim Robbins is in this. It's really good and really thought-provoking. What are your thoughts, like, after hearing all this, James? Are you more intrigued by these concepts or more worried about, like, where these companies are taking us?
I mean, I don't have a lot of faith in humanity generally, so I think that
fair right now. Yeah,
when you couple that up with corporate interests and the legacy of a dead person, I have absolutely zero faith in it. But a couple of things a couple of people said similar things, which is ultimately these things can often help you reflect better on how we actually live our life, I think, which is, it's, you know, it's a little sort of hallmarky, but I think there's a truth to that. When you see like a representation of ourselves that would last on as after our death, and you really think about how you want that to be represented, then you sort of think, well, maybe I should start doing better in the now. Right. And then, you know, the real legacy will be memorable rather than a nice digital one. I just think it's an interesting idea. People will do it. It'll go a little bit wrong. But if it works for those people, then it's good for them.
That's kind of like a new spin on like the religious justifications for the afterlife, too. Like, you got to be good. Otherwise, you'll be punished in the afterlife. Whereas now it's like, well, no, you'll be punished because people will have a bad memory, virtual version of you.
Yeah, or if,
after
or
you die,
if you're if you don't do X or Y, then I'm going to make sure that your avatar is, you know, used for like malicious. You know, but I thought about celebrities as well, and being forced to endorse after in death to be endorsed products, which sort of already happens, but
yeah.
But
yeah,
it would be much more accessible, right? If you're the, you know, estate owner of Bob Marley or something like this, and you can have him, like, endorsing Coke, you know, it's just...
What was the one... we're all talking about, like, CG recreations of actors now, but I remember there was the commercial, the Fred Astaire commercial with the vacuum cleaner, which was, like, using... There was, like, digital stuff happening there, but that was less CG and more, like, just trickery to make that happen. That was wild. And that made me think, like, I don't think Fred Astaire really would have wanted to do that. I think he had better things to do with his life. But okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much, James. Where can we find your work on the internet these days?
I mean, that was a much harder question than it was maybe 4 months ago. On Twitter, I'm It's True, I-T-S, T-R-E-W. On Instagram and Threads, That's True, T-H-A-T-S, T-R-E-W. And that's really the main places you're going to find me hanging out online.
Awesome. I mean, I know you're working on radio stuff. I know you have all sorts of other projects. Anything else you want to shout out?
I do a little show on AMP, which is Amazon's sort of... Everyone says it's their Clubhouse rival, but it's not really that. It's playlist radios, basically. So I do Monday, Wednesday, Friday on that, and my username is True, T-R-E-W, on that, if you happen to be an AMP user, which at the moment not a lot of people are.
I have not even heard of AMP. So, yeah, I will check that out, James. Thank you so much.
No worries.
All right, let's move on to some other news. And before we get to other big stories this week, actually, there's an update from last week. Right after we talked about the Microsoft and Activision Blizzard deal, there was a lot more news that kind of happened after that. The companies aren't ready to completely close the deal yet, but they have announced that they have pushed the deadline for the merger to October 18th. And that's helpful because if the deal wasn't completed before the July 18th break date, Microsoft would have been on the hook for a $3 billion fee. So they're still in the works. We're hearing that Microsoft is now talking with the CMA, and they're going to come up with some way to make that regulator, the UK regulator, happy. Also, Microsoft has announced that they have come up, they have made a deal with Sony to provide Call of Duty to Sony for 10 years. So that answers a lot of big questions around this, but the deal isn't done yet, and the regulators aren't fully happy yet. So we'll be keeping an eye on this for sure. Moving on to other news, once again, AI is really the top of it. And this is something that dropped last night. Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg ran a story about Apple testing its own large language model. Some are calling it Apple GPT, and they're working on generative AI tools of their own to catch up with OpenAI. I don't think this is too surprising, but Nate, you're a fellow Apple fan. What do you think about this?
I agree that it's not too surprising. I don't quite know where they're going with it because it doesn't feel to me like something that fits in obviously with their core competencies, which, you know, as we know, the majority of their money is made on hardware. Services is a huge portion of their revenue now. That's all, you know, your Apple Music and Apple TV and iCloud Drive and so on and so forth. And I think the most obvious place you could see this being useful would be in something like Siri, I suppose. But it definitely feels less of a core, like it fits less into their core business model than, say, Google or Microsoft, right? That's my first impression of it.
Sure. I think, like, that totally makes sense. But I also feel like the weaknesses we've seen from Apple lately have mainly been in software, right? Like, you've been tracking, like, oh, man, when is the iPad going to become a decent, like, multitasking operating system? When is macOS going to change? And Siri, I think for a decade, has been pretty useless. Like, it is, And this is true of a lot of digital assistants. Like, I think it is bad at listening to me when I need it to. I think it works best with like an AirPod or something, you know, when you have a little microphone like right up to your face. But Siri on your phone, useless. HomePods, trying to talk to a HomePod is a little better because they have more microphones, but it's not that smart. It's not always that accurate. And to me, it kind of ruins this like really nicely polished user experience Apple tends to cultivate, right? Beautiful computers, super fast chips, AirPods that sound better and better. I just bought a second pair of AirPods Pro because my first just disappeared and I needed them. So it's like these things, we need them, but a lot of the surfaces behind them are very dumb and very like just not as good as they could be. So to me, that makes sense. Yeah, you got to make Siri smarter.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's interesting too, because you mentioned Siri, but I would say that at the same time, like, has there been much advance in like Alexa or Google Assistant either? Like, those are the other two big ones. And it seems like the companies themselves are less concerned with those right now. Like, you haven't heard about it much from Alexa or Google Assistant in a while. Obviously, Google's moved on in a big way to this AI stuff that may...
I think like our conversations, Nate, have basically been this AI stuff is what the virtual assistants needed at the beginning, right? Like, we ended up launching kind of lopsided, where we got the assistants that could hear us but couldn't understand us. And with the power of like this, that's why Microsoft is investing in ChatGPT and everything, and Google has its own thing. I'm sure Amazon is like looking at like, okay, which AI will we support, you know, moving forward? Yeah. That kind of fits for everybody. Do you see any other uses for Apple's own AI tech?
I guess I could see, given how popular and widely used, at least in the US, the Messages app is, it coming into play there. Like, they started a few years ago, something where you could have a Messages conversation with companies. They could support, you know, iMessage in terms of customer support. So it could show up there, would be the next thing off the top of my head.
I could see it fitting in all sorts of places. When we were at WWDC, Apple kept talking about the Transformer model that's going to be in some you know, future services, like the new autocorrect and the latest iOS. And Transformers, just that is the T in ChatGPT. That is like one function of an AI model. So they're already like dabbling in some of this stuff. And from my testing, I don't know if you've seen this, Nate, but the new iOS autocorrect is so much better than before.
I haven't actually installed the beta yet, but that's really interesting.
You did.
Actually,
I have it on my
iPad.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I mostly just type with the keyboard on the iPad. So
that's true.
Yeah.
You kind of have that. But anyway, so Apple working on its own large language model, not too surprising, perhaps a little more surprising. There was the news that Microsoft and Meta have teamed up to release Llama 2 AI, which is a language model for commercial use. So this is an upcoming large language model intended for commercial and research purposes. There was a first version that was also open source, and this looks like this one is as well. It's just fascinating to see Microsoft putting its fingers in so many AI pies, I guess. I suppose it makes sense for them to team up with Meta for something. But to me, it seems like they're all in on OpenAI. I'm not sure how this is different at this point.
Yeah, this is one that I think it's going to take a little while to see what the like actual impact will be for, you know, normal human beings, or even the, you know, commercial usage that they're intending for it. But obviously, you have two massive companies like this teaming up on something like, you can't help but pay attention, right?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps more relevant to our interests, too, by the way. There was a report last night that Google is testing an AI tool that can generate news articles, codenamed Genesis. And the even crazier story is that they've been previewing it with the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and other News Corp organizations. Yeah.
I was going to say, it sounds to me like they're demonstrating it, not necessarily partnering with them yet, right? Like,
not
there's a big difference,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're showing it off to these organizations. But still, that idea is kind of freaky to me. And everybody in the media world was talking about, I was like, oh yeah, okay, so we're just gonna do this now. We're just jumping right into it with Google. Reminds me of when people were kind of jumping right into doing video content because Facebook wanted to really do video content, and that kind of ruined online media for years. Initial thoughts on this, Nate, because you're the news guy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It is in the same way that, you know, it's shocking to see that with a 15-minute conversation and a photo and a prompt, you know, we can put Devinger into South Park. In the same way, it's not hard to imagine, you know, Google putting its muscle behind this and actually making, you know, relatively short form news articles that get, you know, 90% of the way there. And even 80% is going to be enough for a lot of these corporations. Like, you see CNET and Gizmodo obviously testing the stuff where it's like 30% of the way there, and they're not
barely
backing
there. Yeah.
Right. They're not backing off on that, though. From our write-up, some of the people who saw the demonstration described it as, quote, unsettling. So that's great. It said it also seems to disregard the kind of work that goes into writing accurate, digestible pieces. So, you know, maybe I should temper my expectations a bit. It sounds like it's very much in the demo phase, not in the ready for human consumption phase. And I think what's really going to be most crucial here is how corporations like The Times, The Post, The Wall Street Journal respond to these kind of demonstrations.
I think Google is presenting this as like, hey, here's just another tool. You like autocorrect? Here's like a story launcher, you know, get some headline ideas, get some lead sentence ideas or something. Like, let's just help you get started writing the thing. To me, this is like our conversation with Edward. Like that is very much like, it's a very optimistic idea for this, but I could easily see this being misused so quickly. The New York Times has a quote from Jeff Jarvis, who is a well-known journalism professor. He says, if this technology can deliver factual information reliably, journalists should use the tool. If, on the other hand, it is misused by journalists and news organizations on topics that require nuance and cultural understanding, then it could damage the credibility not only of the tool, but of the news organizations that use it. End quote.
Hard to
that
argue
sounds
with that.
Very similar to the issues we've seen around AI written stories so far, right? Like it's hurt the credibility of CNET for sure.
Definitely. And when we've had internal discussions about like this is all theoretical at this point, but how would we potentially use AI? And the conversations we've had are mostly around ideation, right? Like type in a headline and get 10 more different versions of the headline and like, you know, do some brainstorming there, right? Or, you know, research, like pull up, you know, whatever, 15 articles about this topic to like get your mind going. So it's mostly in that, yeah, brainstorming ideation way, not in terms of like write something that I'm going to just publish. But it's easy to imagine other places jumping straight to that because others have.
So it's so easy. It's just like another button. It's just like a next step. If you have the ideation part down, like it's not that much harder to have the thing just write rather than pay, lowly entry-level reporter or something. Also, like, this reminds me of like how much the news industry has just been ruled by Google, you know, and things for so long, mate. Like,
right.
Were you, I don't know, we probably don't do this as much now, but I remember like a decade ago, a lot of sites and blogs would be like, okay, this is trending on Google News. Let's get a story about this going. And that kind of focus, like how coverage kind of ran for a while because it's what people were into and sites just ended up following. And that was all basically aggregated data, or, you know, it's not too different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think to some extent it's still, Facebook was obviously part of that for a while, right? Things are trending on Facebook. We should write about them sort of mentality. And when I say we, I just mean like the industry broadly. I think it's definitely still a thing. And like in the same way that, you know, sites like ours and other publications are very concerned with optimizing for search at this point because Google drives so much traffic and so much of the way people find things is through that. So it's important to be able to get our stories out there. The important thing is to do that without compromising the work, right? And you know, some places are more open to kowtowing to like what Google search wants, right? And so it's easy to imagine them doing so with AI as well.
I almost wonder if like there's also the potential for things that use this tool and this template to just perform better on Google. And then is that like a self-perpetuating loop where like Google's like, we're going to give the story a bit of a lift because it was created.
That's a
by
good mention. I feel like I saw Google. I don't have the story off the top of my head, but I feel like this week we saw Google come out and say, no, we're not going to rank an AI story higher just because it's written by AI. Like I think somebody sure. wrote a story about this and said that, yeah, they could do this. And they came out pretty quickly and said like, no, we're actually not.
But so, were they talking about their AI or another AI?
Good question.
I'm talking specifically about their AI.
Yeah.
Because this is a company whose motto used to be don't be evil. And now is very clearly.
I'm going to see if I can find that so we can follow up on this next week.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was announced. I remember that story. That was before we even knew this Google thing existed. So
right. Yeah. It was like at the top of the week.
Yeah. So anyway, another like a sign of the apocalypse for the media industry. We'll be keeping an eye on it, folks. Also this week, Intel announced that it would be giving up on its Nook PC business, and this is a tough thing to explain. So Nook stands for Next Unit of Computing, and it's something Intel has been exploring for years to make really tiny, cute, little, adorable computers. I've reviewed a couple of them. I'm sure
this news must have cut you to the core, right?
It makes me sad, but also like every time I reviewed one of these, I'm like, nobody should buy this. It's too expensive. This plan doesn't work, Intel, because they tended to be, I've been reviewing like the extreme boxes, and these are things meant for gamers, and they're all DIY boxes. So you end up spending like $1,000 or more for your box that already has a CPU, but you need to add RAM, you need to add storage, you need to add your own OS and kind of build it up. By that point, you're spending close to maybe $600 to $1,000 more than just a normal size gaming desktop. And
just let Dell build it for you, right?
Just let Dell build it for you or something, or just build it yourself. You can easily build it yourself for a lot less than this whole thing. So I love the idea. I love that Intel was like focusing on it for so long, but now I think they're just throwing in the towel now. And everybody was sad for a while. And then a couple days later, news dropped that Asus is taking over this business. So Asus has come up with an agreement with Intel to develop new NUC PCs. They're also going to be building the existing ones. Asus is in charge for now, and we'll see what happens next. We like Asus computers. I like Asus hardware in general, so that's not, this seems like a very good fit, like giving this to a hardware manufacturer rather than Intel itself.
It seems like a very logical move, and also an easy, relatively easy for Asus to like enter this new category, right? Just by picking up some existing, tech and R&D and just iterate on it from there. So hopefully they'll crack some of the things that you haven't liked about it.
Yeah, totally makes sense. I feel like the idea, it just making it completely DIY seems like the tough thing. But if Asus can crack like, hey, here's a cute little box that sits on your desk and is super powerful and can play games. Just looking at what they're doing with the ROG Ally, right, which is a handheld, pretty powerful gaming PC. I could see Asus going the other way and being like, people want small boxes that can play games. And maybe some of these ideas can go into future handhelds, because
I have to think about it.
Sam gave the ROG Ally a pretty decent review. I think it was like a score of 82. But I'm looking at reviews from elsewhere. They're like, this thing is unplayable. Like, I cannot. Really? I would not recommend you buy this thing, because Windows in a handheld format like this doesn't work. Whereas the Steam Deck is built for it. So anyway, lots of potential there. Something real quick I want to mention is RIP Calibri. The default font in Microsoft Office, it's been around for a while now, for 15 years.
Yeah.
It's going away. Microsoft is moving over to Aptos, a modern successor to Calibri, which looks like it can handle both serif and sans serif fonts. I appreciate a good font. I know, like, especially when I was working on stuff in college, like sometimes just the font stuff, like, okay, I will feel good about this as I'm writing in this font or something. I don't have any particularly deep knowledge of it. I like Aptos. It looks nice. Nate, do you have any thoughts, any design thoughts around this?
I think it's funny to me because Calibri still feels kind of like the new font.
It's new
to me, right? Because Times New Roman, like that was the jam when I was in college using, Word to write stuff. And so
I would always go to like Georgia. Georgia was like a slightly more elegant Times New Roman.
Sure.
Was a nice font.
Yeah. But for me, and I'm sure other people of a certain age, Times New Roman is always like the default font in their brain. But for people, 10 or 15 years younger than me, Calibri might be. But on the other hand, a lot of those people are also probably using Google Docs rather than Microsoft Office. I mean, I think anytime a brand makes a big, it sounds kind of silly, but at the same time, like this is literally the first thing that lots of people who use this extremely popular product are going to see. So like it takes consideration. So I think it'll be interesting to see what the response is once they start rolling it out.
I want to be clear here, by the way. It looks like Aptos is specifically a serif style, but there's an Aptos variable style, which looks like a sans serif font to me. That's like where you have the little curlies.
And they also, it was interesting because Microsoft did like a contest, so to speak, where they asked for submissions, and they had five total fonts that they were considering, or typefaces, and the four that didn't make the default cut are also going to be available. So there's going to be some new options for people who like Devinger who want that nice feeling of
new fonts, good feelings. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, our school library occasionally had good fonts. So I'd take a floppy disk, I'd copy a font over. And at one point, the librarian was like, "What are you doing?" I'm borrowing a font, okay?
I agree.
Get off my back. Like,
The notes app that I use on Mac and iPhone, Bear, has a default Avenir Next. And the first time I used Bear, like I was like, this font is making me feel pretty chill.
fonts make us happy. Like design, that's just design sensibility. So I'm sure that all goes into like how Microsoft thinks of these things. Let's move on to some stories from around Engadget. Our new health tech reporter, Malek Saleh, has a story called "Why Are Non-Diabetics Suddenly Wearing Continuous Glucose Monitors?" And this is responding to some TikTok trends and trends on social media where people are basically charting their blood sugar levels and they're not diabetic. And they're using these devices to do this, to optimize their eating habits or something. Pretty wild story. I have not noticed that this was happening, but we do have some quotes from some doctors who are like, these things are not meant for healthy people. So your body is already regulating it properly. You're not actually learning much from these devices. But anyway, people are still using them. They're very expensive. So it seems like another weird fad. Check out the story. I think it's pretty cool.
How much, when you say expensive, how much are we talking here?
Okay, well, let's look at pricing. One company, Nutrisense, does not accept insurance coverage because it is a wellness program. It has monthly subscriptions starting at $225 and no commitment plans reaching $399 a month. Devices also need to be replaced about every 7 to 14 days. So that's why it's so expensive.
Month.
You're basically, yeah.
That's wild.
That's just, okay. This is bad. I'm very glad Malek wrote about this. This is just pretty crazy.
It feels like exactly the kind of thing that could start trending on TikTok and like have no actual reality behind it.
Oh my God. Social media health tips are just the worst thing in the world. I'm seeing this a lot too. Like I see social media like computer tips and iPhone tips. And I'm like, I have had to DM people directly because I'm like, you are lying to people. You are telling people the wrong things. Yeah. Always fun. Don't believe everything you see on the internet, folks, but especially don't believe social media. Sam Rutherford also reviewed the Nothing Phone 2, which he calls an offbeat alternative to boring mid-range phones. It looks cool. It has cool lights in the back and a transparent case. It's a $600. It will be in the US as well, right? Like I think the first phone was not here and the Nothing Phone 2 will be sold here. So that's cool. That's different.
I do like the transparent case. It brings you back to, again, the 2000s era where everything was transparent and life was good.
Make everything transparent again. We all love transparent gadgets. And this looks cool. It's an Android phone. It seems like the cameras are fine. For a mid-range phone, it has like a really cool, it has a hole punch front-facing camera. It has pretty thin bezels. It has an OLED display with 120 hertz refresh rate, which you don't even have on the iPhone at this point. Yeah. So that's cool. If you're into Android phones, this is one worth considering. And also back in Apple land, Billy Steele reviewed the Beats Studio Pro. This is the latest version of their over-the-head noise-canceling headphones, the wireless ones. Score of 81. Billy seems to really like them. The knock I see here and from other reviews is that they're not super comfortable and the build quality is kind of suspect. And this is something I've noticed when I've bought Beats stuff before. Have you seen this, Nate? Like, they just feel a little too plasticky, a little too flimsy. I'm like, this is gonna break compared to when I buy AirPods or something.
Yeah, the vibe that I'm getting is that the physical design hasn't changed much, and it's been a long time since they released a new a new model of this type of headphone, so it's a little surprising that they haven't improved it. It sounds like it has some nice features for people who are cross-platform, like if you use iOS and, you know, Windows, for example, like they have better switching for that sort of situation. But my main thing is I'm like, I don't see why you would get these over the Sony's. They're $50 cheaper, which is not nothing. These are already expensive products. So like
that's, these are $350 to be clear. So, and the Sony, like the MX that we really like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Typically go for around $400. I often see those things on sale though. So it's like,
yeah, they go on sale not infrequently and they're just great. Like I just don't see like any reason to recommend and almost anything over it. Like Sony has such a lock on that right now that it's like you have to do a lot to beat them.
What is the actual overhead Apple one called? I keep forgetting that even
exists.
That's
the AirPods Max.
Yeah, the AirPods Max. Yeah.
Word is they're going to update those this fall most likely because it has been, I think, over 2 years since they came out. Apple put some interesting new like adaptive transparency noise canceling features into the AirPods Pro that it sounds like are not coming to the Max. So like that would be an odd, right? I think, I don't know if it's a hardware thing or what, but yeah.
That's something I'm looking forward to testing on the AirPods Pro 2 that I have. Adaptive, because I'm always riding the transparency or blocking thing, especially when I'm like moving from a subway to the streets in New York or something, like always switching it up. It's just funny, like the AirPods Max came and like you just never see them. You see like Marques Brownlee wear it on his videos, but I never see them.
I see him in the city. You're out in the middle of nowhere, so that might be why.
I'm near a city too. Even on planes, fair. Like planes, and like when I travel to New York and stuff, I just don't see them that often. But we're also just not talking about them that much. Again, the Sonys, folks. Look at the Sonys. You can often find some of the like 1000XM, either the 4 or 5s, and they may have new ones coming. Those are great headphones. They just sound good. They work so well.
You can't go wrong.
Cannot go wrong. If you get them on sale, just go for that. Also, Billy Steele is our grill master. So he just wrote up a guide of the best grills and grill accessories in 2023. Really makes me want a pizza grill because these Uni grills just look so beautiful. Yeah.
I've never really thought about that. But, I mean, like, it's become, I think, a lot more popularly. And now I'm like, you know what? I kind of want one. But then I look at the list and I'm like, it's $800. And I'm like,
There are cheaper ones out there. And I think one of the biggest people selling Uni grills at this point is probably Matthew Panzerino from TechCrunch. The editor-in-chief of TechCrunch is like always, I think he used to be a cook. And so he's always out there. He's like, I've made five beautiful pizzas. Behold, Twitter. And
I have
a
friend who makes some really good pizzas. I bet he's on this jam already.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, you can get a good pizza oven at home. The problem with doing a pizza typically in your oven is that they don't get hot enough. These Uni ovens get super hot and also can be powered by all sorts of different things. So it just seems really fascinating. If you're into buying pizzas, look at these Uni things. Let's move on to some listener emails. And folks, you can always drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We have one from Rohan, who's responding to our ideas of using the iPad as your main computer. And he's expressing his overall theme here is, quote, "The iPad is the versatile computer for the rest of us, but Google and Apple won't let it become one," end quote. I think that's a very interesting thought. So I'm going to read from his email directly here. He used to work at Chevron, and Chevron is all in on Microsoft for desktop computing and predominantly iPhone for mobile, though Samsung S-series phones are permitted thanks to the magic of device management. The same goes for the iPad. All of it works brilliantly and seamlessly, and you know what enables that? Microsoft. Yes, the very same Microsoft all the world during the era of Gates and Ballmer balked at, but the Microsoft of Nadella is a different beast. It just works. Because unlike Google, their apps are absolutely robust and not a poor man's version of the full desktop experience. Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Teams, and OneDrive on the iPad absolutely rock and made better when Apple enabled proper external display support on Apple Silicon-equipped iPad. Then he joined a company that moved over to Google Suite, and Google's native apps aren't even close to the functionality of their native web apps, and some of the iPad OS interface makes matters worse. I'm looking at some screenshots here. Google Photos doesn't work when plugged into an external monitor. Honestly, I haven't even thought of the idea of like using an iPad with an external monitor and what that would be like. But
I can tell you all about it, Devin.
Yeah, tell me, Nate. Like, what is your experience with this?
Well, I'm going to say first, Rohan's point that Microsoft has made all of its apps work really well on the iPad is really interesting because, I think that for a lot of people at this point, those apps are overkill. Like I don't need Word. Like Google Docs is like 100% gets my needs accomplished.
What if you did, Nate?
I was about to say, I recognize that that's not true. So it's really interesting to hear that Microsoft's apps are so far ahead of Google's on the iPad.
I remember this, by the way, like when these things dropped, we were all like, well, holy crap. Microsoft is just like really building good apps for iOS right now.
And yes.
That was surprising. Yeah.
Definitely. I will say, I don't know what iPad Rohan is running. So I don't know. So external monitor support with Stage Manager requires an M1 or an M2. He mentioned Apple Silicon. Obviously, all iPads run Apple Silicon, but you need the M series, not the A series, to get good external monitor support. I was in our New York office a few weeks ago doing a review, and while one of our video guys was shooting the laptop, I actually hooked up my iPad to the monitor there to get some work done. And, you know, it's pretty good. You can have like 4 different apps running on the monitor, 4 more on the iPad screen, and you can switch between different, air quotes, stages. That's what they call it in Stage Manager, right? So you can get a lot done there. This shot he sent us of Google Photos not running on the external display, again, I don't know what iPad he's running. I guarantee that's a Google thing. You know, their apps are often kind of hit or miss in terms of taking full advantage of the features that iPadOS offers. So I'm not surprised to see that being a little wonky. And his point about this, the predictive text bar showing up. Yeah, I've run into that. It's super annoying. Sometimes there'll be a little window that pops up and blocks the text spot. So like, it's definitely not, you know, it's maybe not as good as a Surface in this regard because the Surface is just running Windows straight up, right? Whereas iPadOS is still kind of like straddling this line between being a full, like they've added, I mean, the multitasking stuff they added in the last year and a half with Stage Manager makes a really big difference if you want to try and use the iPad as a quote real computer. But I'm also not surprised to learn that Rohan is having some, you know, there's a learning curve or some growing pains or stuff isn't fully optimized. I will be interested to see what they think when iPadOS 17 comes out and if anything improves there.
That's a good point. While you're here, Nate, since you know what I'm going to ask, what is the better pseudo computer, a Chromebook or an iPad trying to be a computer?
I would say an iPad trying to be a computer is better, but it's also, you know, two or three times more expensive. So actually I might walk that back.
That's not true. You could get the 10-inch iPad for 400-ish now.
Okay. But I would say that one is not good to use as a computer because it doesn't do Stage Manager. So you're stuck with two apps on the screen. But I think that, you know, the $400 iPad and a basic Chromebook are kind of in the same ballpark where you can do, you can do a lot of the basic stuff you want to do, right? Like the Safari browsing experience is good at this point on the iPad. Obviously Chrome on a Chromebook is great. And since, you know, 90% of what we do is either in a browser or in like the apps that you want to download on an iPad, like, you can get there. But you know, as soon as your needs expand a bit, it gets a little complicated and you probably want something more flexible.
You're swimming in compromises with either option right now, it seems. I actually just picked up one of the newer 10-inch iPads because I had a lot of credit card points. And I was just like, well, this could be useful
is
in
it,
our house.
With a home button or without the home button?
Without the home button. So it's the one with like the camera like on the side a little
colorful
bit.
Colorful back,
It's one of those. Basically, the latest 10-inch model that was over $400. And we said, like, that's not a great deal when they used to sell them for like $329.
Get on sale.
But I was like, I need something with more storage, something I could use with my kids, and something a little more powerful that could run like Minecraft and stuff. I didn't want to go all the way up to the iPad Air. And this thing, I bought a keyboard case for it too. It's like, okay, now it's like a 2-pound. I just need to go right. I just need to go somewhere and write. I don't need to worry about multitasking. I just need to like open up Evernote or whatever I move to in the future because Evernote seems to be dying. But I just go sit somewhere and write on that thing. It's fine. And also, I totally forgot about the whole like using it as an external display for your Mac feature.
Also handy. I'm doing that literally right now.
Super handy. It just kind of works. So I could totally see it. Like, to me, the iPad has become like a really nice symbol of computing, which is maybe more than I can say for Chromebooks right now. I don't know. I like them just fine, but give me cheap Chromebooks. Like, give me. I wish we had more like $100 or $200 Chromebooks that were viable because I think that would be excellent.
I need to go take a look at like the best budget options because I haven't for a little bit because like there's been lots of like, you know, premium ones that cost more than most people want to spend. I'd like to see, what can you get for $300 or less that's like a viable device?
I think probably one of the ones meant for education or something. But, you know, I remember the Asus EPC back in the day. It was like 2005 to 2008 or something. But I bought one for my wife at the time. I was like, holy crap. It is a $300 mini computer, and it was
netbooks,
fine.
Baby, netbooks.
Netbooks. She used it for years. It was great, really? And to me, more useful than Chromebooks ended up being. So, anyway, thank you so much for your email, Rohan, and really appreciate this feedback. Rohan is from Singapore, and it's really nice to know we have international listeners too. Folks, you can always drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com, and also, you don't have to email it to us. You can also leave us a voice message or something, and we will work it into the show. Just leave a voice memo on your phone. Let's move on to what we're working on right now. And honestly, I'm just trying to juggle a whole bunch of stuff that I have to finish before I'm off for vacation in August. And that's it. I'm trying to cram in a bunch of stuff. I'm going to be seeing Oppenheimer later tonight and hopefully write about that.
I was about to ask if you've seen that yet.
I I missed my chance to see the press screening, so I'm just going to see it the soonest I can in theaters, and hopefully we'll have some coverage up on the site on Friday. Nate, what's up with you?
I am going on vacation, so I'm kind of wrapped up. So I'll be off next week, and then it sounds like you're going to be off shortly after that, so our paths will cross again at some point. But I'll be looking forward to seeing if you publish anything on Oppenheimer. What about Barbie? Are you going to see that?
I'm definitely going to see Barbie, because we have to review it on the Filmcast at some point. So, you know, I'm doing Barbenheimer, because I'm seeing Oppenheimer tonight. I'm seeing Barbie tomorrow night. Yeah.
Nice. I think, I love Greta Gerwig's Little Women, so I'm looking forward to Barbie.
I've loved everything she's done, so I'm sure it's going to be great. Yeah.
I still don't quite know what it is, but I kind of like that.
It seems like a lot of things all at once. So anything else you want to shout out? You've read a lot of books, Nate. What are like the top handful of books you'd recommend from this year?
Yeah, I was going to say that I have a stack of books right next to me.
So
and
jealous.
One of the ones I just finished is called Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. And the cover makes it look a little fluffy. It's a woman with a pencil in her hair and big sunglasses. It's a book about a woman in the 50s who is an outstanding chemist in all of the misogyny that she faces trying to get heard. And she takes a really interesting path towards becoming an authority in her field via being a TV star on a cooking show, where she, instead of being the like prim housewife that people thought they wanted to see, then she goes at it from a science angle, because if you know cooking at all, there's a lot of science there. And she like just goes for it and is like, this is what is scientifically happening when you make things, and this is how it works. And it's just I was surprised at how much I liked it. So that one I would recommend, Lessons in Chemistry. I also just read a book called Not Alone, and that's by Sarah K. Jackson. It's an apocalypse book, which I tend to be a fan of.
Or see Station 11, Nate?
Yes, and loved them. I think Emily St. John Mandel is brilliant. Her last book, Sea of Tranquility, was fabulous.
Okay.
So there you go. Three book recs for me.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much. And podcast producer Ben points out that there's an adaptation of Lessons in Chemistry coming to Apple TV Plus later this year. That seems really, really exciting, Nate. Yeah?
Yeah, I think that'll be great. It looks like it's starring Brie Larson. Apple TV Plus has a pretty good track record at this point, so my hopes is that they will do this one justice. But I imagine it could, given the star power behind it, be another breakout one that hopefully gets more people to read the book as well.
For sure. Apple TV Plus has done a good job of just making things that are good, like, right, good enough, maybe not always great, but good enough. And the person who is working on this also worked on Jury Duty, Little America. He actually developed Little America with Apple, and I love that series. That series was fantastic. So,
I haven't seen it. We'll add it to the list.
It is really good. It's the one about immigrant experiences in America, but it's fantastic. But thank you so much, Nate. I'm waiting for the time where I have time to read again.
Nobody I know who has kids is able to, so I understand where you're coming from.
Even before kids, it was just so tough. But okay. Thank you so much for your picks. And you also had some pop culture picks too, right?
I had one thing I've been watching, or I've been playing, excuse me. We love Katamari Reroll. It's the second game in the Katamari series that was released, I want to say, around 2007, 2008.
I don't remember anything good about this. Yeah.
What? You don't remember anything good about it? Oh, man, those games were delightful. Highly recommend checking it out. I love the first
one. Yeah.
Yeah, the second one is just as good. It was still, the creator was still involved. It kind of expands to different levels you can play on. There's still like make it as big as possible, but there's a lot of other like interesting challenges. And the thing that I loved about this is that it hasn't been available. Like the original Katamari has been available for a while on different platforms. This one hasn't been re-released until now. So I just was excited to try it again after, not playing it for more than a decade.
Where are you playing it?
I'm playing it on the PS4/5, but you can get it on the Switch and Xbox as well.
Does it still have like a super addictive like J-pop soundtrack? Like that's
the music is wonderful. It's not as good as the first games, but basically any Katamari game, the soundtrack is a standout.
Yeah, I remember after Katamari, I had like a bunch of music soundtracks on a disc, and I would play it in my car and just playing little like Rolling Shining Star.
Yeah,
in a car, just it's very incongruous, but it works. Yeah,
I have the score from the first game on vinyl. because I'm that guy.
Of course you do. Check out, I think it's 8-Bit Big Band that did a really great big band rendition of Shining Star.
Oh, that sounds great.
It's really good. My pick is Justified City Primeval. And this one is for fans of Justified or fans of just like great detective stories or noirish stories. This is a reboot of Justified, which was the Timothy Oliphant series that ended in 2015. I loved Justified, to be honest, especially early Justified. I kind of honestly just I stopped watching maybe like season 3 or 4 because there was just so much other TV. So I have over the last month been binging the last bits of Justified that I haven't seen and just jumping into this new one. It's good stuff. Timothy Oliphant, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, where's the old one and where's the new one?
The old one, it's all on Hulu right now. So the old one, all the entire series is up there. The new series is a Hulu series, maybe technically AMC, but it's all showing on Hulu right now. And this follows up with Raylan Givens, Timothy Oliphant's character, I think about maybe 13 or 15 years after, because... you know, a big plot point is he has a kid early on, and I think the series ends with his kid basically being like in daycare or something. So like now his kid is a sassy teenager played by his Timothy Oliphant's actual daughter. And she is very good, actually. And he just like slips back into this role so well. And the man has been typecast as, you know, cool cowboy man. Like he even did it in Star Wars. When he popped up in the, the Boba Fett-esque armor, just the way he like leaned, I was like, oh, God damn. He didn't even take off the mask. He didn't say a word. He just like leaned in the door. He's like, that's Timothy Oliphant. He is just so typecast and he seems pretty fine with it. He's very good here. This is a very good series. It moves from Harlan County, I think that was Tennessee or Kentucky, to Detroit. So it's more of like a city story. He's trying to chase a ruthless killer played by Boyd Holbrook. Boyd Holbrook, if you want like a slimy villainous man, like he just pops up everywhere. He's in Indiana Jones. He was in
similarly Lincoln. Typecast, but in a similarly way that typecast, he kind of gets into. Yeah.
Perfectly typecast. Anyway, I'm really just enjoying the new Justified. I was worried they were just kind of be going back to the well and it being a little not as good as the first series, but no, it's very good. I think even stronger in some ways. So yeah, check out Justified City Primeval on Hulu. That's it for this week, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter. I'm still on Twitter a bit. At Devendra at mastodon.social and at Devendra on Blue Sky. I am on Threads. You can find me there. I do not plan to be posting on Threads. So that's just me. Nate, where can we find you?
I, unlike you, am planning to be on Threads a bit. At Nate Ingram is where I'm at there. I have more or less shut down my Twitter presence. So I'm, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I suppose, in this case. I'm on Blue Sky. I just need to spend a little more time getting set up there. So I might do that as well. Nate Ingram at on Blue Sky as well.
Cool. I think we've talked about this a bit, but it does seem like our social media communities are just splitting up and going to different places. So I have followed people to Mastodon. That's where the tech people are. And cybersecurity people. There's a lot of good techie folks there. And Blue Sky is where a lot of media people and entertainment people I follow went to. So
if the media people are on Blue Sky and the tech people are on Mastodon, does that mean the people on Threads are just basics?
I used that word with Sherlyn when Threads started. It was like, oh, all Threads needed to do was exist. And Sherlyn was like, I'm there. Give me the clout. Anyway, we miss Sherlyn. Sherlyn has been in super busy, so that's why she's not here this week. Find Sherlyn on Threads. I'm sure she'll appreciate the follows and the engagement. And as always, folks, drop us an email at podcastinggadget.com. Let us know where you want to be on social media. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Before we leave, here's my chat with the writer and director of They Clone Tyrone, Joel Taylor, and Tony Rettenmeier. This movie stars John Boyega, Jamie Foxx, and Tiona Paris as people living in a city who stumble upon a government cloning conspiracy that could have, wide-ranging implications for their community. I think this movie is a ton of fun. It's kind of a cross between classic 70s blaxploitation films, but also science fiction. And it juggles all that while being pretty funny and honestly saying something very topical as well. The Clone Tyrone premieres on Netflix today, July 21st, and it's well worth taking a look, especially if you're a fan of Jordan Peele's latest work, too. Here's our chat. Joel Taylor and Tony Rettenmeier, thank you both so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you guys here. So I saw the movie a couple days ago, guys. My mind is still reeling from all the ideas and everything you're working with here. Clearly, you've got a lot of genre influences. Can you tell us like what led to the invention of They Clone Tyrone?
Yeah, I mean, I think really it was a thematic question of like, you know, is there a difference between blame and responsibility, you know? And I think that thematic question mm-hmm. kind of married with wanting to make a bootleg Scooby-Doo movie. So I think we were really influenced by, you know, the Truman Show, They Live, you mm-hmm. know, in terms of just tone, you know, Jackie Brown and Big Lebowski, Boogie Nights. And so, you know, we really were just trying to make something that we would want to watch if we mm-hmm. were just at a movie theater randomly and, you know, you saw the poster for it. You're like, oh, that's a cool poster. And if you went in, you're like, I'm liking this. So I think a lot of it was just us trying to make ourselves laugh a lot of the times.
Tony, anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, try to make something thought-provoking, but first and foremost, make something that's entertaining and that we would have fun watching and that we would have fun at making.
I like that this movie also, you guys aren't shying away from like the genre ideas and genre conventions. It's called They Clone Tyrone. We know what we're getting into here. How do you feel about the ability for genre films, sci-fi and horror films to tackle deeper themes too? Because I feel like this is a thing we're seeing more and more recently with Jordan Peele's movies, but this has been around for a while. I feel like we just haven't had, the filmmakers haven't gotten the support. I'm thinking back to like Candyman, honestly, even back to like the first, Night of the Living Dead. There's always commentary with these genre formats. How do you guys, how do you approach that? Do you think this is a better way to deliver some messages so that audiences don't think you're like pushing didactic messages through their, you know, down their throats?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you use that word didactic. We use it a lot too, because we try our best not to be. You know, we avoid being prescriptive like the plague for sure. You know what I'm saying? I think genre, it allows you to, you know, it lets the audience relax a bit, you know what I mean? And put the walls down a bit, right? And so, you know, you can have something thought-provoking, but like entertainment can still be at the forefront of the mission. You know, I think, and genre just, you know, it's a shorthand. So, you know, I think it allows you to slide, you know, ideas, things that, you know, things that might be like percolating in your mind in a way that like is a little more digestible, you know?
Yeah. And I think genre gives you sort of, it comes with like pre-established conventions, and so you can play against something mm-hmm. and the audience usually knows, you know, whether they consciously or unconsciously like know the sort of limits of each genre, and so they can tell when you're playing against that, and like in playing against that you can, you know, be talking about something thematic. Tyrone has an aspect of like meta-ness to it that I don't want to like say and spoil, but like
sure.
it comes from playing against. There is sort of a deeper thematic message in it in playing against the genre that it presents itself as.
I also want to talk to both of you about Mr. John Boyega, who I think is a star in this movie, but I also remember the first time I saw him was in Attack the Block. And at the end of that movie, when everybody's chanting Moses, Moses, I was like, this guy is going places. Like, I want to see him in all these movies. I want to see him in the biggest franchises. He had Star Wars. I think Star Wars did him a bit dirty, to be honest. But he's gone to do like many, many like serious, really, really fascinating dramatic films too. Like he did A Small Axe with Steve McQueen. Can you guys talk about how he embodied different versions of this character that's being cloned? And you can avoid spoilers. You know, there's stuff towards the end we don't have to talk about. But he clearly had to like look at this character in several different ways, right?
Well, John, kind of not spoil something.
Yeah, there's like one big one. We don't need to spoil. It's fine. Yeah.
Well, I'll say something that and Joel, you can elaborate on it, but you know, John Boyega in the movie plays a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, talking about our question that came before, sort of like going into genre conventions and stuff, there is like sort of a certain like movie convention of like what a drug dealer is and what the sort of like psychology of a drug dealer is and stuff. And John Boyega, through Joel's direction, was able to do it in a way that, at least for me, like, was something that I hadn't seen before, you know, mm-hmm. rather than this like alpha dog, violent, you know, street dude. Joel had him play this sort of a dude that was like tired, that had this kind of like inner like ennui to him.
There's a world weariness there. Yeah.
Yeah. And boy, and again, like, trying not to spoil anything, there is mm-hmm. like kind of a story reason for that and everything. But he was able to, like, I say all this to be that, like, to say he was able to take a character that we've seen 1,000 times and twist it in a slightly different way that had a lot of like resonance to it. And I think that was like a credit both to Joel's direction and his ability as an actor.
Tony's downplaying this, because I mean, Tony, the character is also, you know, scripted this way, you mm-hmm. know, so like, don't let Tony fool you, you know. Tony is as instrumental in the character as anybody else, I think, you know, and more so than my direction. It's really John bringing that out of the character, right? Like, he's a more mm-hmm. stoic character on the page, you know, like, and John, you can't direct someone who has natural warmth to be warmer. Like, you know what I mean? He is warm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He is funny. He has dry humor. And he brought all that to the character, you know, in spades, way more than we could have imagined it would be. You know what I mean? Like, he made us laugh. And like, you know, even we were just doing takes, like, he would make us laugh, you know what I mean? And in dramatic moments and areas that were absolutely not scripted to be comedic, but he would do things that were, you know, acerbic, you know what I mean? Like, he has this dry wit that's, you know, it's sneaky, it sneaks up on you.
Yeah.
And he has so much like, just like grounded, so much of it, such a grounded energy, you know what I mean? That he really, you know, he takes all of these disparate sides of himself in this movie and gives each of them something that feels unique, but also grounded in its own way. Right. And I think that's just a testament to how amazing of an actor he is.
Have you guys seen Breaking, which was the other movie he starred in this summer?
Of course.
Yeah. Incredible.
Our good friend directed that. So Abby Corbin went to USC with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we were actually there at the same time as Abby. And so it was awesome seeing. And again, it's like totally different John.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he still has that commanding presence. You know what I mean? He still has that sense of authority, that weight, you know. He killed it. I love that movie.
Yeah, I love the, like, even the like, outside of our movie and the actual like act performance work, I like the like series of like we mentioned, the choices John makes in his career, like from going from the biggest movie that you can do, like a Star Wars movie, to now, like, he seems super like in intentional in picking roles that are very, very different from each other.
Yeah,
you know, like the character in Breaking, which I think, if I'm correct, is like the movie he shot. Did he shoot after or before Tyrone?
After.
After, on one side, like, very, very different from Tyrone. Like, completely, or, you know, from Fontaine. Completely different, you know. And I think just, you know, as just like a fan of, like, Hollywood movies and stuff, I like that he's choosing something. He's continually choosing something very different than what he's done before.
Yeah. He's, I mean, and like I said, he, you know, he can always step into that Star Wars role, and, you know, like, I think he could easily lead a Star Wars movie, and fans would love it, you know.
Hopefully, yeah.
You know, yeah, hopefully, right? Like, so, I mean, he has, it kind of reminds me of Robert Pattinson, you know what I mean, in terms of, like, can hit you with the AAA blockbuster.
It's true. It's true. And he could do the Cronenberg. Yeah.
And he could do the Cronenberg. Yeah. Fuck with us on a little weird movie. You know, so come get weird with us for a while. Go AAA. Something that's super
dramatic. I'm waiting for the John Boyega going totally weird kind of movie. I think that would be a lot of fun. I don't want to like ignore the rest of the cast either too. I think both Tiona Paris and Jamie Foxx bring a lot to this role or to this movie. I also want to say it is great news to see like Jamie Foxx out in public too, because I know he was sick for a while here in Atlanta and people were really worried that, yeah, who knows what was going to happen to him, but he seems on the mend. Can you guys talk about just what they brought to the film too?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think Tiana is just like, she is a beast. Like she was like, we wanted her like from the very beginning in terms of from the initial round of casting. Like we circled Tiana just because I loved her work all the way back to Mad Men, you know, Dawn, like, and like she has, you have to have a crazy amount of charisma to be on the screen with Jamie Foxx and to go like, you know, blow for blow with Jamie Foxx. Like she has an insane amount of charisma. Like it just oozes, she like oozes star power, but she's also like a wonderful dramatic actor, you know, and so she can balance, you know. I think the one thing all three of them, you know, we were so fortunate that they all were like game to balance like the comedy with the dramatic parts of the film, you know what I'm saying? And bring like, you know, like again, this groundedness, because I mean the type of satire you're playing with, like it can easily get unwieldy if the characters aren't grounded.
And yeah,
so she's such a grounded actor, but she has so much like power, force, like vitality in her performance, and not just this movie, you know, that, you know, I don't even have to say anything about you. We all know what Jamie is doing. You know, he can roll out of bed and kind of do anything he wants. He's really a savant. Like I
think he's one of the greatest actors of his generation. So, you know, it's like, it's really fun to see him do this. Yeah.
You know, and so obviously Jamie just, you know, he brought stuff off camera, like in terms of just like his intuition, you know what I mean? Just knowing like the vibe. He did a comedy show one day and we had a bad set and like a bad day and it's going sideways and we hear all this laughing in the parking lot and Jamie is doing the show for like the background actors and it was just people off the street. We shooting on location, so you know, a bunch of people off the street, we all just laughing. He's literally doing a comedy show in the parking lot of like a beauty salon, and you know what I mean, like, and that was just him understanding his role, because like he's naturally going to be a leader on the set, because like, I mean, we look up to him, that John and Tiana look up to him, right? Like, you know, we all look up to him, you know, and so he kind of understands that, like, you know, he's like the elder statesman on the set, right? And so he took that responsibility, like, you know, seriously, in terms of just like doing what he could to like keep morale up. So it goes beyond the screen, because it kind of, what he does, you know, his talent as an actor kind of speaks for it. You know, the man has a Best Actor Oscar.
Yeah, he does.
Like,
yeah.
We joked. We were like, it should say featuring Academy Award winning. Like, when you put
the, it should be there in the trailer. Yeah.
Academy Award winning. Like, you know, it needs to say that.
Like, as the pimpiest pimp you'll ever see. Like, he's having so much fun, too.
He's so on his reign. Now, he and Slick Charles.
Moving forward, I'm wondering, like, are both of you planning to stick with science fiction and genre for your future projects? Is there anything you want to talk about, or, you know, are you planning to change things up a bit?
I think in our ideal world, every new project is something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of that Kubrick kind of model of like, you know, hit them with something that they didn't expect after every movie.
Yeah.
I think we love sci-fi because we love world building. You know, and that kind of goes hand in hand with sci-fi. But I don't think we're too like prescriptive with genre, you know, it's whatever we can imagine ourselves like having fun doing, for however many years it takes to make it.
Those are my favorite types of filmmakers, like Danny Boyle. I feel like he will never make the same type of thing twice, except for Trainspotting. And even that ended up being pretty good for him. So that was good. But good to hear. I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys work on next. I have a couple tech-related questions for you now. You're both young creative types. And I'm wondering, how do you both live with technology? Like, what are the gadgets you rely on in your life? And you can't say your smartphone, because we all rely on our smartphone. So it's like, what is it that helps you do your work these days?
I'll say one that is probably pretty relevant to the current time and obviously relevant to the writer strike that's going on right now. But in terms of ChatGPT, you know, I've come to, like, when I write, I have it pulled up next to me. I don't use it for, let's say, creative. I use it for one creative purpose, which I'll talk about later. But usually it is a great sort of as a highly effective search engine. It's great, you know, and it can help with anything from, like, if you have a quick question, like, hey, are there jungles outside of Bangkok? It'll tell you right away. Or it's like, hey, I need some common, like, you know, Korean names. It'll give you a list in a way that Google will too, but it's just faster. So it's like, it's less of an interruption in terms of the creative process when you're actually trying to write. You know, it really is like talking to someone. Creatively, I've used it a couple of times for concepts or ideas, but I use it, you know, nothing against the, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm the, you know, the dude on the horse that's saying, like, you know, cars will never replace us or whatever, but, like, at least in its current iteration, I don't think it does creative idea generation very well. So if I have a concept or a scene, I might type in the log line to that concept or scene and see what it comes up with. And I know that, like, if I see something there that I was coming up with as well, I consider my idea bad, because I consider my idea is like, oh, that's it must be a cliche way to go.
So generic,
Or too expected of a way to go. So, you know, it's almost using it, I think, as a canary in a coal mine for, like, cliche or generic ideas.
That's really,
you know,
smart.
Maybe that'll change, you know, like, I don't know if, like, I can't say what the future is. I'm not, you know, I don't know that enough, but at least currently right now, that's how I interact with it in terms of the creative process.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, that was such a good answer. I feel like anything that I say will fucking step down. So I'll say my, I'll go with, like, my PS5 and my Steam Deck.
Well, okay, that's a good bring up there. So you're a Steam Deck player. How do you feel about that? Because that is so different than, you know, the older consoles. Like, we are seeing so many of these handheld gaming PCs now. Are you into that trend?
Yeah. I mean, like, I originally went to school. I wanted to do video game design.
Joel's played or seems to know about every game that's ever been made.
Oh, I would love to see a game from both of you. So that's cool. That's good to know.
I finally bit the bullet, you know, because I was going to get it. And I was like, I'm just going to get it, because I've never played modded Morrowind.
Okay.
You know? And I was like, if it kills me, I'm going to play a modded Morrowind. And so I was like, let me just go ahead and get a Steam Deck right quick. I've actually been playing Hi-Fi Rush on it. I got Metal Jesus Rocks on, like, YouTube with, like, reviews, like, you know, video games, and had a crazy video game collection too. But he reviews all these, like, you know, kind of indie consoles, and, like, I'm fascinated by, you know, as many emulators as I have had, and as many ways I can play it, I'm always still, like, looking at new ways to,
like, the Steam Deck is the kind of, like, Jesus device that can do everything if you're smart enough to know how to get those emulators in there. So, yeah,
I mean, you know, you get you, like, a nice terabyte, like a SD card, and you can kind of do whatever you want on it,
and you can still hook it up to TV and, like, actually play games like a console too. Miracle device.
Yeah, just a Switch. I was playing Zelda.
The production company's set gift to Joel at the end of production was a PS5.
Right here.
So that's
very nice.
See, it's a, I guess I can't see, but it's a big clone Tyrone.
Oh, that's cool. I see that. Oh, that's lovely.
The little PS5. I was literally playing Tears of the Kingdom, like, life before him.
This is great. This is great. I love like the newer generation of filmmakers to have like, we all played video games. And I think that was something that wasn't quite there for some of the previous generations, which maybe explains some of those video game movies. So, okay.
Storytelling in indie games, especially, is super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's something, I don't know, again, I don't know enough about the world, but it seems like indie games are going in through that explosion that like movies did in the late 80s and 90s when all like the price of making movies went way down. And so the creativity went way up.
Yep.
But there's some of these indie games that are just like true, like works of art.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I even think back to like getting to the end of Braid and like,
yeah,
it was in reverse time.
Going backwards. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you know what I'm saying? Like it still sticks with me. And I think like kind of to Tony's point, you know, there's, it is art. Like
it sounds like I would not be surprised if you guys come up with a game project eventually or something related to games. So that sounds super cool. Last question for you, which is a bit of a thought experiment. So you all know Mad Max, you kind of know the world of Mad Max, and what happens in that franchise is basically there's an apocalypse, right? There's an EMP or something. Technology stops. We have to live with what remains, you know, all the cars and devices and everything. If you had to pick one thing to help you live through that Mad Max apocalypse, what would it be?
I got it. Wait, does it have to be? Okay. Well,
whatever you want.
So I actually want to do this. I've watched a lot of Dooms Preppers videos of people that build these little like cherry pie computers in a Pelican case, and they load all of Wikipedia on it because you can download all of Wikipedia.
Oh, you'd be like the Oracle in the future. Yeah.
I have no other useful skills, man. I don't know how to build a house, so I gotta like earn my little can of peaches some way in the apocalypse.
Yeah. I mean, Tony keeps saying all of the most
I've thought about that one.
I know,
like, that's a good idea, man. You gotta have that.
You're ready for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, that's the funny part. We talked about this. That's why.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll go a little bit because it's funny. I'll go slightly different. I would actually say something like a Steam Deck or like something where I could load everything on.
It's a computer. You could do whatever you want with it. Yeah.
Tony has all of the human knowledge loaded onto, you know, Wikipedia, so we can start farming again. We can, you know, we can get irrigation going again. We can just get society up and running. And someone needs to preserve the art, you know, something.
Yeah.
The art. So, you know, you get a Steam Deck, get the biggest, you know, biggest memory you can put in that thing and get every emulator, get as many movies, get as many albums, you know, download them on there. So you can, that way you can rebuild society from the art side and like from the, you know, from the city planning side.
Hey, that's what they say in Station 11.
I was, you know, just going to recommend. Yeah, have you guys seen Station 11? Yeah,
yeah. Survival is not. What is it?
Survival is not sufficient. Yeah. So, and the whole point of that's a post-apocalyptic story where art and our love of art is really the thing that keeps us going. So, I think Joelle, you just kind of landed there too. So that's fun. Thank you both so much for joining us on the podcast. Where can we find you online these days? Are you guys on social media among the many many different services now?
Not really.
I would recommend it for both of you, just because I think people are going to be searching for you and wanting to hear from you. So yeah,
problem, man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People searching for you, I get antsy, man. I made a Twitter like when it came out.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Instagram when it came out, but they fell into like disarray and disrepair, mm-hmm. and disregard, and so like they're just on the internet somewhere. You know, I still have my Instagram, but it's like I haven't posted it since like 2013.
I mean, you guys have been busy too. You've been doing apparently on a lot of projects from what I can see on IMDb.
And I've just been playing video games. Like,
okay, well, you know what, hopefully Tony, anything you want to shout out?
No, the same. I mean, hopefully, yeah. Hopefully they get to. Hopefully, this movie does well, and we get to make another one. And
I'm thinking like where would be your platform of choice? Because I think people will see this and want to know what you guys are up to and what you're thinking. And yeah, it's good to talk to those fans. But Joelle, Tony, thank you both so much for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, man.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.